This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
This week, Ruth Ezeki on her latest novel, The Book of Form and Emptiness. Ruth Ezeki is a novelist, filmmaker, and Zen Buddhist priest. She is the award-winning author of three novels, My Year of Meats, All Over Creation, and A Tale for the Time Being, which was shortlisted for the 2013 Man Booker Prize and translated into 28 languages. She has also written a short memoir, The Face, A Time Code. She is affiliated with the Everyday Zen Foundation and lives in Northampton, Massachusetts, where she teaches creative writing at Smith College and is the Grace Jarko Ross 1933 Professor of Humanities. Her latest book is The Book of Form and Emptiness, which is what we're going to be talking about today. Ruth, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
First of all, tell us how you would describe this novel.
Yes. Well, it's a story about a young boy, Benny O, who loses his father when he's 12 years old. And in the wake of that, is quite traumatized and begins to hear the voices of objects in his house and in his surroundings speaking to him. And at first, he doesn't quite, you know, he doesn't really understand exactly what they're saying, but he can kind of understand the feeling tone. And, you know, this becomes a problem because his mother, Annabelle, is a bit of a collector. You know, she's a bit of a hoarder. So, you know, the house is quite cluttered with things. And so it becomes quite cacophonous there. And eventually he seeks refuge at a large public library where, you know, libraries, of course, are filled with objects and filled with objects that speak, right? Because, of course, books do speak to us. But, you know, they're orderly. They stand up in order on shelves and they speak in their library voices. So he finds this very soothing. And he meets a, you know, sort of cast of characters, the denizens of the library, young artist who he falls in love with, and a poet philosopher who holds literary salons in the men's washroom. He meets a kind of superhero librarian. And then he meets this very special talking object, which is his book. And they start to have a conversation, Benny and the Book of Form and Emptiness. So the Book of Form and Emptiness actually is narrating the Book of Form and Emptiness into being. And it's, you know, through this relationship that Benny learns to, you know, find his own voice and to sort of listen to the things that matter.
So, yeah, this is why I specifically said, how would you describe this novel, when I often might say, how would you describe this book? And, to avoid confusion, because in this case, literally the book itself is a character in the novel. So let's talk a bit more about this idea of the book being one of the narrators of the story.
Yeah, well, it was an idea that I don't think I started with this idea. I started just, I think, writing in a, you know, sort of third person, fairly omniscient, you know, point of view. And then from time to time, though, Benny would break in, you know, and I would hear his kind of first person voice breaking in and interrupting this narration. And soon it became apparent to me that Benny was talking to the narrator and that the narrator, you know, was kind of talking back to Benny. And this was really my attempt to, at first it was my attempt to write in an omniscient third person, you know, because all of my books are usually written in multiple points points of view. And I had it the back of my mind that, you know, that real novelists, the ones who are truly deserve the title, right, should be writing in the third person omniscient, right? And so this was my attempt to do so, but it soon fell apart. And in fact, you know, the book ended up becoming a character, and of course does have the omniscience, you know, that super omniscient capability that books do have, but it can also slip into other voices as well, because books are also, you know, like that, they're kind of ventriloquists, right? And so that's really how the idea, I think, sort of evolved. It wasn't really even an idea, it just kind of happened.
And you mentioned that, you know, a lot of the book takes place in a library, and obviously, I mean, with the caveat that you're a writer, I'm a books podcaster, so obviously we're a bit biased, but, you know, the book talks about, you know, the centrality of books in our lives as well.
Yeah. I mean, this story too is about a young person who's helped by a book. And I think my last novel, A Tale for the Time Being, you know, was also about a young person, a girl, now Yasutani, who was helped by a book and also helped by, you know, the act of writing. And so I think this is a theme that connects the two novels. And, you know, it's clear where this came from. You know, I was a child who loved books, and, you know, I was a child who loved writing. And to some extent, I think, you know, the reason that I'm here today is because of books and writing. I sort of found my way through some very difficult patches early on, because of books. And so I think, you know, that was the area that I was kind of exploring in these.
So you mentioned that Benny has lost his father, Kenji, at the beginning of the book. And obviously this is a tragic event for the family, but it's also a slightly ridiculous event in the sort of means of Kenji's death. And I wanted to talk about why you chose to kill him off in such a comical way.
Yeah, it was, in a way, I was thinking that there really isn't anything worse than losing, you know, your life or losing a loved one in a way that is, you know, that can't be taken seriously. You know, Kenji, in this case, you know, he's a jazz musician. He's been out performing and afterwards hanging out with his friends and drinking and, you know, doing drugs and on the way home, he falls asleep. He stumbles in an alleyway right near his house. And, you know, once he's down on the ground, he doesn't really see the point in getting up, you know, and he's lying there in the alleyway, kind of gazing up at the street lamp and, you know, looking at all of the little tiny particles of moisture floating around in the air and he falls asleep. And then, a few hours later, a truck comes along and by then, you know, Kenny has made friends with a flock of crows. And so the crows have flown down and they've covered him, you know, to kind of keep him warm and dry. And the truck driver, who is driving a truck filled with chickens destined for a slaughterhouse down the road, sees this, you know, this lump in the road covered with crows and just assumes it's a garbage bag and aims his truck at it. He hates crows and aims his his truck at this bag and runs Kenji over, you know, and Benny, whose house is, you know, really just, you know, right there overlooking the alleyway, his bedroom window is overlooking the alleyway, you know, he sees his father, lying in the alleyway and sees him die. And, and this is a obviously a traumatizing event, but at the same time, you know, it's one of these, you know, events that there was a comedic element to it as well. And I was thinking, really, what could be worse than that, to have something, you know, so terrible and so, you know, traumatic happen, but also, you know, have this other element to it that is almost not serious.
And so, as you said, Benny starts to hear the voice of inanimate objects, and they don't necessarily speak to him because he cannot understand their language, but he hears their voices. And I wanted to talk about this idea because, of course, what happens in the book to Benny is, you know, he becomes pathologized and, you know, he's taken to see a psychiatrist, etc., because hearing voices is, you know, clearly a thing that happens to a lot of people that are considered unwell by, you know, psychiatry. So I wanted to talk about this idea of the objects having a voice.
Well, I think I entered into this really thinking about voices. And, you know, after my own father died, for about a year, or so after that, from time to time, I would hear him, I would hear his voice. And I'd always be doing something, you know, fairly random, like, you know, washing the dishes or folding the laundry. And, you know, behind me, usually to the, actually it was always to the right-hand side behind me, I would hear him clear his throat and then say my name. And I would whip around and look for him because it was so convincing that hearing this voice with my ears. And I'd whip around and look for him. And of course, he wouldn't be there. And then I'd remember, oh, of course, because he's dead. And every time this happened, you know, I feel a kind of that same pang of loss and grief. And then I just, you know, kind of ignored it. I just kept doing what I was doing and forgot about it quite quickly. But it happened about, half a dozen times, I'd say. And then eventually it sort of faded away. And so that's what happens to Benny too. You know, I kind of gave him that early experience. And then, but in Benny's case, instead of his father's voice kind of fading away and nothing else happening, he does develop this kind of sensitivity so that he starts to hear the voices of objects. And I started thinking about this because, you know, in my, you know, as a novelist, right, one of the things that I do is, you know, listen to characters speaking to me, right? This too is an unshared experience. Nobody else hears these voices, but I do, right? And I was speaking about this at a library event, and one of the audience members raised his hand and asked me if, you know, I really heard these voices, you know, when I spoke that way, did I hear the voices of characters with my ears, or did I hear it? Was it more like I heard it inside with my mind, right? And so I explained the difference. I said, you know, certainly for fictional characters, it was more a kind of a more internal experience, as if I was hearing them with my mind, but that I did know what he was talking about, because I'd had this experience with my dad's voice. And it turns out that this man had a son who heard voices in that way, as though they were external to him. And the voices were very critical and harsh. And this was a very disturbing experience to his son. And, you know, so I started thinking about that. And of course, thinking about all of the internal voices that I also have and that many writers have, you know, that are also very, very harsh and there in the background telling me that what I'm doing, you know, the writing that I'm doing is terrible. And, you know, I should just give up because nobody will be interested and I should go out and get a real job. And, you know, surely there's a better way of spending a life than sitting in front of a computer. You know, there's all a whole chorus of voices that talk to me like that. But I was thinking how really disturbing it would be if those voices were talking to me and I was hearing them with my ears as though they were, you know, as though they were outside me. And this really got me thinking about this idea of voice hearing as a spectrum, you know, and on one hand, we have the sort of the creative side where hearing a voice of a character speaking to you or a line of poetry or, you know, a bar of music or, you know, having a vision, right? And painting it, you know, on one hand, this is sort of artistic inspiration and something that is really looked at in a very, as a wonderful thing, right? As a kind of a, you know, artistic and wonderful thing. And then there's that large area in the middle of the spectrum where hearing internal voices, you know, the voice of the critic and all of that is, you know, you can call it a kind of neurotic phenomenon, right? And then on the, you know, on the other edge is, you know, the voices that are deemed to be by the psychiatric profession, deemed to be, you know, pathological and psychotic or, you know, schizophrenic. Those are the diagnoses that one most often receives and really, you know, seem to be a pathology, right? And you know, it was interesting to me because we have such a narrow bandwidth in our culture for what we consider to be normal, right? And I was really thinking that, you know, what if we could expand that bandwidth and to encompass both ends of, you know, the entire spectrum? Because there are many people who hear voices who are not bothered by them. It's only when you're, you know, when you're bothered by by an external voice that it becomes a problem. And, you know, ironically, Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, you know, the fathers of psychology, spoke about the voices that they heard. You know, Joan of Arc heard voices, right? Mahatma Gandhi heard voices, right? So there's you know, a lot of people who hear voices who, you know, are not bothered by them, and it's just not a problem. So this was the kind of area that I was exploring. And then the idea of object speaking, you know, that was something else. You know, I started thinking about that because, you know, when you hold an object, not every object, but certainly many objects, you hold an object, you do have a sense that, you know, that there's a story inside it somehow, you know, that the object has been around for a long time. And, you know, there's narrative in there, if only it could speak to you. And this was something I felt very strongly when I was cleaning out my parents' house after they died. You know, it was filled with objects that had belonged to my grandparents, and especially my Japanese grandparents. And I really, you know, I remember thinking time and time again that I just wished that these objects could speak, and because I knew that they had wonderful tales to tell.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and today I'm talking to Ruth Ozeki about her book, The Book of Form and Emptiness. And Ruth, just to carry on directly from where we just broke, thinking about the voices of objects and hearing voices of possessions, for instance, again, this is something that we can see on some sort of spectrum, where that's loving certain inanimate objects and investing in them some sort of personality on one hand, and at the far end basically is getting to hoarding and not being able to throw anything away. And I say this to bring in Annabelle, Benny's mother, who basically after Kenji's death has something of a precipitous fall into, basically becomes a hoarder, and her house becomes full of objects that she both can't throw away, but also stuff that she compulsively buys. So first of all, tell us something else about who Annabelle is, and then we'll look at this side of her.
Sure, yes. Annabelle, you know, is she works as a media monitor, a news clipper, essentially. And so, when her office downsizes, all of the workers are sent to work from home. And as many of us have done, right, during the pandemic, she suddenly finds herself at home, with all of the equipment and the files and the papers and all of the paraphernalia, that used to be contained outside the home. Suddenly, all of that stuff has to move inside. And, in Annabelle's case, that means a lot of newspapers and magazines that are flooding into her house every day that she has to scan. And, she clips articles that are of interest to her clients, right? And so she's, receiving all of this paper media. And then she gets, assigned other duties as well, listening to radio and making dubs of, radio shows and television shows. So, her house then slowly fills up with equipment as well. And then the company has an archiving policy, so she's not allowed to throw this stuff out immediately. And it starts collecting in garbage bags, and you can imagine it's kind of a nightmare. But at the same time, too, Annabelle, she's a very creative person, and she sees the potential in material to become something beautiful. And I think this is something I love about Annabelle. She's got a lot of a lot of problems, but she can't go into an art supply store without imagining, all of the, the paints and the, the fabrics and the, all of this material stuff becoming something. And she sees the future, the possibility in everything. She also sees the past in things. So, for example, she can't bear to throw away Kenji's flannel shirts, or his clothing, because, she still feels, some essence of her love in the fabric, in the warp and weft of the fabric. So she just can't bear to, to throw things away. So of course it does become a problem. And it was something that I really was feeling strongly, during the pandemic, when all of us were suddenly contained in these spaces that felt increasingly small, the longer the pandemic lasted, and the longer the lockdown lasted. I think I was kind of thinking about that and really just thinking about, yes, again, just all of the associations that we have with our material possessions. Do we possess them or do they possess us?
So as well as books having a voice, a literal voice in this novel, there are certain books that are also in other ways animate. And there is a book that basically follows Annabelle around, leaps into her shopping trolley at one point and then basically follows her around. And this is like a sort of Marie Kondo-like. The book is called Tidy Magic, a sort of a Zen guide to tidy in your apartment. So I just want to bring in how the book is also looking at ideas of overconsumption and consumerism and the effects that is having on us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I debated whether or not, the Tidy Magic book should fall within, the larger book of Form and Emptiness. But, there was something about, I was just fascinated by the Marie Kondo, phenomenon in the West, and fascinated by the way that what Marie Kondo is kind of teaching is really basic common sense in Japanese culture. The idea that, that you should treat your objects, treat your possessions, with respect. So for example, if your socks have developed a hole because, you've been wearing them so much, you should hold them in your hand and kind of feel a moment of gratitude before you throw them out. Right. And in Japan, indigenous Japanese religion, Shinto religion is really Marie Kondo's background. And it's a very animistic religion, tradition. And so, for example, in Japan, back in the day when, say, for example, a sewing needle or a pin was really a precious object, it was hand wrought and, something that you would, that you would really take care of, right? Eventually it would break. And instead of just throwing it out, the woman would, would hold on to it. And then once a year at the local shrine, they would have a memorial ceremony for broken pins and needles. And so then you would bring your broken needle to the shrine, and on the altar would be a block of tofu, right? And you would put your, you know, broken pins and needles into the block of tofu so that they would have a soft resting place, right? And then, you know, a funeral service would be held and, you know, a proper kind of memorial would be held in order to kind of send them off. And this was, you know, an expression of gratitude because the, you know, the object had served you and had, you know, broken during its service to you. But it's also, there was an element of you know, there was a kind of safety precaution in there as well, because pins and needles are sharp and they can hurt you, right? So it behooves you to treat them with respect and to, you know, to give them a proper send-off at the end of their lives. And so this was the kind of thing that, I don't know, I just, there were kind of elements and cultural differences in the way that we treat our objects. And I felt like I wanted to talk about that in the book. And so thus the entry of the Buddhist nun Icon and her book, Tidy Magic.
With the Maria Kondo phenomenon, I also saw at the time that, you know, well, obviously there is ridiculous rampant overconsumption as, you know, one of the conditions of capitalism, and the world cannot any longer support that lots of ways. And so the idea of revering less stuff is clearly a good idea. At the same time, particularly in the UK, over the last decade or so, there's been a sort of completely unnecessary economic austerity program put upon people. And in the UK, a lot of people started, you know, becoming obsessed with sort of like, you know, wartime make do and mend and like crap stuff. Which again, on the one hand, clearly in a world where, you know, the climate is rapidly increasing is a good idea. But on the other side, of course, this was clearly something that was obviously only aimed at a certain percentage of the population, i.e. people that were like, you know, were being financially pressed in other ways that were obviously unnecessary. And again, I can remember thinking at the time that the Marie Kondo phenomenon was also another sort of propaganda for, hey, it doesn't matter that you've not got any money anymore, you shouldn't have it.
You know, it's interesting because hearing you say that, of course, it kind of reminds me, it's kind of the opposite of the Martha Stewart phenomenon, right? Marie Kondo is like the anti-Martha Stewart, you know, and both were used, you know, for political, you know, and economic ends, which I think is actually, it's kind of an interesting slant to, you know, to take on it. You know, I was kind of just, you know, sort of playing with these ideas, but I guess, you know, in modern production, obsolescence, you know, of course, is designed into things. You know, things are designed to break, and obsolescence is a feature, not a bug. And you know, is that really the way we want to do things? You know, it seems worth thinking about, right? And our means of production seems to me it's worth a review.
In one of the ways, I mean, obviously, you know, the appearance of the Tidy Magic Zen priest in the book is an indication of it. I wondered what are the ways in which your own, you know, being a Zen Buddhist priest, your own practice has informed the writing of this novel?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, this novel, like the A Tale for the Time Being, has a kind of overt Zen theme that runs through it. And both novels have Zen nuns, you know, in them, you know, who are characters in the story. And so, yes, I think the Zen themes in this, you know, in this novel are, you know, are clearly present. And, you know, but at the same time, you know, I guess, in the West, you know, Zen is looked at as something kind of abstruse and special somehow, right? But it's not really. I mean, Zen is just, you know, it's a practice. It's a mindfulness practice, and it just, you know, it's just life, right? It's nothing special, you know. And the principles of Zen are just kind of principles of reality. You know, everything is impermanent, and we're all, you know, interconnected. Right. We can't live independently from each other. And I think, you know, these are the themes that actually are at the heart of any piece of literature, right? That, you know, suffering exists, you know, because our attachments to things are so strong. This is what you know, this is at the heart of, I think, every novel, right? These kinds of themes. So in that sense, you know, I think that in this, you know, in the case of these two books, certainly the themes are kind of, you know, identified as Zen as such, but, you know, they would be there anyway, even if they weren't.
To finish it off, can I get you to read it a bit?
So start with the voices then. When did he first hear them? When he was still little? Benny was always a small boy and slow to develop, as though his cells were reluctant to multiply and take up space in the world. It seems he pretty much stopped growing when he turned 12, the same year his father died and his mother started putting on weight. The change was subtle, but Benny seemed to shrink as Annabelle grew, as if she were metabolizing her small son's grief along with her own. Yes, that seems right. So perhaps the voices started around then too, shortly after Kenny died. It was a car accident that killed him. No, it was a truck. Kenny O was a jazz clarinetist, but his real name was Kenji, so we'll call him that. He played swing mostly, big band stuff at weddings and bar mitzvahs and in campy downtown hipster clubs where the dudes all wore beards and pork pie hats and checkered shirts and mothy tweed jackets from the Salvation Army. He'd been playing a gig, and afterwards he went out drinking or drugging or whatever he did with his musician friends, just a little toot, but enough so that on his way home, when he stumbled and fell in the alley, he didn't see the necessity of getting up right away. He wasn't far from his house, only a few yards from the rickety gate that led to the back of his house. If he'd managed to crawl a bit further, he would have been okay. But instead, he just lay there on his back in a dim pool of light cast by the street lamp above the Union Gospel Mission thrift shop dumpster. The long chill of winter had begun to lift, and a spring mist hung in the alleyway. He lay there, gazing up at the light and the tiny particles of moisture that swarmed brightly in the air. He was drunk, or high, or both. The light was beautiful. Earlier in the evening, he'd had a fight with his wife. Maybe he was feeling sorry. Maybe in his mind he was vowing to be better. Who knows what he was doing? Maybe he fell asleep. Let's hope so. In any case, that's where he was still lying an hour or so later when the delivery truck came rattling down the alleyway.
So I've been talking to Ruth Ozeki. We've been talking about the book of Form and Emptiness, which is her latest novel, and it's out now from Canongate. Ruth, thank you so much for taking the time to share it with me.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.